Hello, this is Dr. Andrew Weil. I want to talk to you about sound and healing and my interest in how sound affects our minds and bodies. This has been of great interest to me for a long time. I think everyone is interested in sound, even if we don't know that consciously. But if I think back to when I first consciously became interested in the effects of sound, it was when I was in India when I was 17. I was with an international student exchange group, and at the start of my time in India, I was in Calcutta. This was in January of 1959, a long time ago, and it was during the full moon. And one night, a girl who was in my group from Ohio, who had never been out of Ohio, and I wandered away from the hotel we were staying down to the banks of the Hooghly River. There was a great girder bridge over the river, and the moon was up, and we found a small temple that was right on the riverbank, and we were drawn to it. There seemed to be no one around, and we got there, and suddenly an old sadhu appeared out of the temple. He was the caretaker of the temple, and he came up and said good evening to us, and we said hello, and I don't remember, I think we may have exchanged a few words, but he suddenly made the most extraordinary sound that I'd ever heard. He was chanting, and it was just spellbinding, and I felt the sound through my body, and then when he finished, was silent, the sound continued, and I just had never had any experience like that. And then he said that the sound that he had made was Aum, and that this was the fundamental sound of the universe, that it was the original sound that encompassed all sound. He demonstrated how the sound of Aum begins in the back of the throat and then extends through the mouth and finally winds up with the front of the mouth, with the lips. So it encompassed all possible sounds. Well, it was just amazing. I'd never heard anything like that. And that got me very interested in, first of all, in chanting. And I began to listen to chanting of first recordings of Gregorian chant and then later to Eastern chanting, and I began doing this myself. At some point, I remember coming across and really thinking about the line from the New Testament from John that in the beginning was the Word, that the universe was created with sound, that there was an utterance, that the Creator made a sound, and that this brought everything into manifestation. And as I pursued my study of the sciences in college that led me to go to medical school, I became very interested in the idea that everything vibrates. I mean, this is a principle from physics, that everything that we look at is vibrating, and sound is the propagation of vibration through a medium. So if you think about it, you know, everything in the universe is singing, whether it's from an atom to an electron to a black hole at the center of a galaxy. Everything is producing a sound, and the essence of sound is vibration. The essence of vibration is a waveform. It's like two polarities, off-on, positive-negative, being repeated at a certain frequency, and that then is propagating through a medium. So I became quite interested in the idea that we live in a universe of sound, that we are really immersed in a universe of waves coming from many different sources, crisscrossing, meshing, merging, interacting. And yet, I think for many of us, our dominant sense is vision. And so much of the brain is occupied with vision, and vision so overwhelms us that I think we often are less conscious of the sound nature of the universe, even though it may be affecting us in very strong ways. I remember other experiences that I had of the power of sound. One was being around large bells being rung, church bells, bells in Buddhist temples, where the vibration is so powerful that you feel this in your physical body as an overwhelming experience at the same time that you're hearing it. Another was sitting in concerts of classical pipe organs and feeling the sound as much as hearing it and really being transported to other places by that. I have a great love of Bach played on the organ. I think one of my absolute favorite pieces is the St. Anne Prelude and Fugue. And I can remember hearing this performed live many times and the experience of feeling that vibration in my body at the same time that I'm hearing it and being absolutely transported to other realms. I'm tempted to say celestial realms by that music, you know, very impressive. Another experience that I remember having that was quite powerful was being in the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. This was during the 1970s, early 1980s, when I was doing botanical studies, and a very good colleague of mine, a botanist from Harvard, was director of ethnobotany at the Field Museum, and I used to spend time with him there. And one night I was there on Founders Night when they had the big donors to the museum come and the museum pulled out all the stops. And one of the things that they did for the donors was to have a live gamelan concert. The Field Museum had an antique gamelan ensemble from Indonesia, and they had recruited players of it. There were many instruments, you know, a lot of variations on gongs and percussion instruments. And they played, I think, three pieces, but one of them was described as a war chant that was used to prepare warriors for going into battle. And my memory of it was that it was a simple melody that was repeated over and over, getting louder and recruiting more and more of these percussion instruments. And my experience in listening to this was that I began to feel adrenaline surges through my body. And at the end of it, I really wanted to smash something. You know, I wanted to just break things apart and smash them. And I was absolutely astounded at that sound could have such a dramatic experience on my emotional life that produced that, you know, really feeling of rage and wanting to, you know, wanting to go into battle. And then as I was aware of that, one of the ruminations I had is wondering, you know, what are the effects of sounds that we take in unconsciously? And one of the experiences that I'm sure many of you have had is you're driving in a city and you pull up to a stoplight and a car pulls up next to you, you know, with some incredible beat at over volume. I mean, I think this is now illegal in many cities, but it rarely seems to be enforced. But, you know, you wonder what is the effect of that, especially, you know, when you're in a situation driving in a city where often people are aggressive anyway, and there's this unconscious taking in of sound influences that may, I think, be very counterproductive. You know, my sense is that when you're in that situation, you'd want to be calmed out and chilled out, not necessarily made more aggressive. And I think there's a lack of awareness of the power of sound. So as a physician, I got very interested in the effects of sound on physical health, on mental health, on emotional health, and especially on whether people are conscious or unconscious of the effects of the sound environment on them. I find when I'm in a, you know, I live in the desert in an area that's fairly quiet. And if I go to a city like New York, if I'm in Manhattan, the hardest thing for me is dealing with the noise, whether it's jackhammers, sirens, horns, screams, and it's a constant environment. But when I talk with or stay with people who live in the city, they've become relatively unconscious to it. You know, we become tolerant to sounds. This is a well-known phenomenon that the brain stops responding to a repetitive sound. And yet, what are the effects of this sound at the unconscious level? I think they're very great. I also feel if I'm in a city like that, if I go to a restaurant, for me, what I want in a restaurant is an oasis. And in a noisy city like Manhattan, what I would like is a sound oasis as well as a visual oasis. And it's very discouraging how many restaurants in big cities now seem to think that it makes a dining experience attractive to have very loud music with a driving beat playing. I think that, I don't know what they think. They probably imagine that this makes the place exciting, but not only does it interfere with conversation, it's the exact opposite, it seems to me, of what the purpose of a restaurant should be. The word restaurant comes from the same root as restore. You know, the idea is that somehow that this is a place that you go to be restored from everything that's outside. Not to mention what the effects of this might be on digestion, because it seems to me that, you know, given that experience that I had in the Field Museum, that if sound can produce adrenaline surges and rapid heartbeat, then similarly, it might have very dramatic effects on other involuntary functions, especially digestive functions. And I think this is really the basis of the whole science of sound therapy, which is a remarkably well-established field. There is an American Music Therapy Association that's been in existence for a long time. There's a great deal of research that's been conducted and published on the uses of sound to promote healing, to promote recovery from illness, to deal with symptoms. And yet I think the majority of physicians are relatively unaware of this whole body of work and never think to use it. It seems to me that the advantages of sound therapy are, first, that it's an inexpensive intervention relative to most of the technological fixes that we use. It's quite safe in terms of its potential to produce harmful effects. The possibilities of producing enormous changes and improvements in people's physical and mental health, I think, are very exciting. Some of the research that's been published demonstrates the, for example, the use of music during labor and delivery to dramatically cut the need for anesthetics in women giving birth. There has been very exciting exploration of music therapy in neurological disorders, from autism in kids, in which it can produce profound increases in connectedness with other people and verbal ability, to people with neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease, where certain kinds of music can actually reduce tremor and improve gait and balance. There is a whole branch of music therapy that specifically looks at using music therapy to stimulate regeneration and rehabilitation in stroke. For example, in a controlled study reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1996, 10 stroke patients received auditory stimulation in the form of metronome pulses embedded in recorded music played through headphones. After 3 weeks of listening for 30 minutes a day, the patients had improved their cadence, stride, and foot placement compared to the control group, and the effect was lasting. So I think this is one very powerful example of the use of sound therapy. There's also has been some a lot of research on the use of sound and music to alleviate pain. Some studies suggest that listening to the music that you find enjoyable may facilitate an increase in endorphins, which are the body's own natural pain-reducing hormones. A 1991 study of a group of elderly men and women with dementia found that recall of words to songs was much better than recall of spoken information. So this suggests that the part of the brain that processes music, singing, is different from the part that processes speech. I've also seen some very interesting case reports of people who have lost speech as, in one case, the result of surgery for a brain tumor. So the speech-producing center in the brain was destroyed, but the person could sing. And so he could respond to people by singing his answers. Fascinating. So that can be developed through the use of sound therapy. I, on the one hand, find this very exciting and interesting. On the other hand, am continually baffled by how infrequently physicians think to refer patients to this modality and to use it. So I guess my interests in sound and sound therapy are very wide-ranging. On the one hand, I have a great deal of personal interest in how sound affects me. I'm interested in the therapeutic application of sound in medicine. I'm very much interested in how the unconscious taking in of sounds from the environment affects us on an emotional, physical level. I'm also very interested in the what I would call the esoteric aspects of sound. And this ventures into territory that probably is fringy from the point of view of conventional science, but I find it fascinating. And let me talk about this for a minute. I remember reading in a book about Gurdjieff that he was very interested in the traditions of using sound to affect consciousness, which he said derived from Sufi traditions in the Middle East and in Asia. And there was a description of him when he was at his chateau in France that he said there was secret knowledge of certain chords that could produce dramatic changes in consciousness. And the person writing this described that there was a young woman present and this evening, and he said that he could tell that she was somebody who was very susceptible to these influences of sound, and he asked her to come and stand by the piano. And he was playing what sounded like an innocent piece of music and suddenly struck a certain chord, and the woman fell unconscious. And so this was a demonstration of the power of this, that you know, a certain combination of tones could produce unconsciousness in a person. And similarly, he said that other tones could actually push a person in the direction of superconsciousness or enlightenment. I find that fascinating. And then the question arises, you know, how does all this happen? You know, what is sound doing to us? Clearly, a sound has a very direct influence on brain function, and this is a well-researched area that I think is more within mainstream science. There is a very well-known phenomenon called entrainment, in which brain waves begin to follow the frequencies of sound that are given to a person, so that you can observe, using an electroencephalogram, very direct influences of sound on brain function. So that's clearly one level in which sound affects us. And this may be the area in which we find the explanations for how sound therapy benefits people with Parkinson's disease, for example, or stimulates progress in kids with autistic disorders. But I think the effects of sound extend way beyond that, into areas that have been less well researched. One of the ways it affects us that I think is most interesting is on the water, which is the principal component of the human body. You know, a mature human body is about 70% water. And there are dramatic influences of sound on water. Of course, you know, if you've ever played a stemmed wine glass by rubbing a finger around the rim, and by the way, this was actually developed into a musical instrument invented by Benjamin Franklin called the glass harmonica, which Mozart wrote a concerto for, which was a series of tuned glasses. But if any of you have done this, you know, if you can actually see the sound waves appearing on the surface of the water following your finger. You can also do this with one of the Tibetan bowls or quartz bowls. If you have some liquid in it, you can actually see the sound waves. So clearly, you know, water is a medium that conducts these vibrations very efficiently. There has also been some fascinating work looking at how sound affects the crystal structure of frozen water. This has mostly been done by a Japanese scientist, Dr. Masaru Emoto, who's published a number of books now with quite wonderful photographs of water crystals and showing how water crystallizes in different forms depending on the sound that it's exposed to. And then he goes much farther, showing that the physical structure of these crystals can actually be influenced by the intention, by prayer, by words, by the content of sound that with which people utter sounds. As I say, this is all in the realm of what I would call subtle energies of how sound affects our subtle body that at the moment is less well understood in scientific terms, that is not generally appreciated by the mainstream scientific community, but may be a major aspect of what goes on when the human organism is exposed to sound.